UN Agency for Palestinian Refugees says for the first time in its history, the organization has run out of money amid the coronavirus pandemic in Gaza. British drug manufacturer AstraZeneca says further research is needed on its COVID-19 vaccine after questions emerge over the protection it offers. And the European Union warns that its assessments on granting market access for British financial services will not be completed in time for January. Hello everyone, thanks for tuning in to World News. Our top story, the UN Agency for Palestinian Refugees laments it is hit by the unprecedented financial crisis.
For the first time in the history of the agency, we have no cash available anymore to cover our spending between now and the end of the year.
Felipe Lazzarini, Commissioner General of UNRWA, says the agency has received lowest levels of contributions since 2012. This is while the coronavirus pandemic is exacerbating the needs of refugees. Lazzarini tells a press conference in Gaza City that the agency is on the edge of a cliff, but it can avoid falling if the international community expresses solidarity. The agency relies on funds from UN member states and the European Union, but its finances have been ravaged by a U.S. decision to slash hundreds of millions of dollars of aid. Lazzarini also warns that the health system in Gaza is about to collapse due to pressure from the coronavirus pandemic. British drug maker AstraZeneca plans to run an additional global trial to assess its COVID-19 vaccine effectiveness. The company's chief executive, Pascal Soriot, says studies show efficacy of the lower dosage of the vaccine is more than the full dosage, and more study is now required to validate that. He noted international trial will be faster and needs fewer patients. AstraZeneca's COVID-19 vaccine effectiveness is questioned as many experts doubt the test trials were scientifically valid. Several scientists raised doubts as the company previously claimed its experimental vaccine was 90% effective in a subgroup of patients who were mistakenly given a half dose, then a full dose. Experts believe that this could reduce the vaccine's chances of getting a quick regulatory approval from the U.S. and the European Union. Now, COVID-19 is still ripping its way right through Europe amid a second wave of the pandemic there. And here are your latest updates. Italy has reported nearly 30,000 new cases and over 800 new deaths. UK witnessed nearly 500 new fatalities. Let me just say 500 to be exact. In Turkey, the daily death toll there hit a new record of 174. Meanwhile, Sweden warned that the worst is still to come, saying that its peak could be in mid-December. European governments keep resorting to restrictions to try to rein in the deadly virus. Greece is among many nations that have extended nationwide lockdown measures. A European Commission unveils a strategy designed to make the 27-nation EU less dependent on imports of medication and medical hardware. The bloc has faced major shortages throughout this pandemic, especially earlier on due to its reliance on China for supplies. Jerome Hughes reports.
The coronavirus crisis has highlighted just how vulnerable the EU is when it comes to even the most basic healthcare requirements, such as having enough face masks. The bloc has also had to import ventilators and medication, mostly from China. The European Commission has just unveiled a pharmaceutical strategy aimed at making the EU less dependent.
We do not want to see, never again, the problems that we faced during the first weeks of the pandemic. Never again.
The plan is to ensure essential items are manufactured within the EU. The European Commission is also concerned that EU nations will not be ready to distribute vaccines when they become available in the coming weeks. Just half of the bloc's 27 nations have published plans. Countries are being told to redouble their efforts.
This means that member states need to have the necessary infrastructure and the logistics, so when there is a safe and effective vaccine, they can roll it out and deploy it as quickly as possible.
Businesses are buckling under the pressure of lockdowns in many EU countries. The run-up to the December and January holiday period is normally their most profitable time. EU leaders continue to squabble over much-needed financial support packages for employers.
We've seen a major shock to the whole of the euro area, major trouble in Spain, in Italy, in other countries. I think the response was too weak.
Officials warn that if COVID-19 restrictions are relaxed too soon, hospitals will be overwhelmed during early 2021. It appears to be an impossible health-economy balancing act for governments. There is concern we are becoming complacent because we know vaccines are coming. Equally, authorities are worried too few of us will take advantage of the scientific breakthrough.
The European Centre for Disease Control says each year hundreds of thousands of healthcare workers in the EU refuse to take the seasonal flu vaccine. It begs the question how many of them, and how many people in general, will agree to be injected with a COVID-19 vaccine. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Russia has accused the US and its European allies of interfering in the internal affairs of Belarus, which has been gripped by weeks of election-triggered unrest.
We have noted numerous facts of gross interference by both the United States and those who follow in their wake, meaning some European capitals, in the internal affairs of sovereign states.
Sergei Lavrov was speaking at a joint press conference with his Belarusian counterpart in Minsk. Lavrov said the West is using a so-called color revolutions, including manipulation of public opinion and radicalization in sovereign states. He said that Belarusian people are able to sort out their problems without any outside prompting and intrusive offers of unsolicited mediation. Earlier, Lavrov met with the Belarusian president, Alexander Lukashenko, whose re-election has prompted weeks of street demonstrations. Protesters say the vote held on August 9th was rigged and demand Lukashenko resign. The European Union has reportedly warned that a decision on whether to offer market access to UK banks and other financial institutions will not be made in time for January. An unnamed EU diplomat said that the European Commission has informed member states that a so-called equivalence agreement on financial services with the UK will not be ready by January the 1st. Financial services are not part of ongoing talks between the UK and the EU on a free trade accord. UK has been seeking a separate equivalence agreement with the EU in order to ensure its companies will be able to serve the bloc's customers once Brexit is up. Britain left the EU in January, and its access to the union's market under post-Brexit transition arrangements ends on the 31st of December. Political analyst Keith Pilbeam says neither the European Union nor the UK will emerge winner from Brexit, but London will be the one that'll suffer more.
Basically, the whole thing is sort of up in the air, really. And, of course, the UK is not responding quick enough to the negotiations. All right, we're at the last minute, and I think it's a warning shot from the EU saying that this is just not appropriate. This is all just to make Boris make his mind up quickly. A decision has to be made, otherwise there's just going to be chaos in Britain. And we can't afford a no deal, so there will be a deal. Have no hesitation about that. We're going to see a deal, but it's going to be a very bad deal. And, of course, the EU is reminding Britain that, you know, are you really prepared to sacrifice everything for fishermen? We should have made a deal, Boris said, in October. We've already reached the absolute limits. It's got to be ratified by the European Parliament, and it's got to be ratified by the politicians. So we really are at the last chance salute. But, look, the EU knows that Britain will come back looking for a deal, if there's even a no deal. By the end of January, we'll be looking for a deal and desperate and not in a very good negotiating position either. There's no winner. They're both losers. But the biggest loser is going to be Britain. That's quite clear. 45% of our trade goes into the EU. Less than 10% of the EU trade goes to the UK. And so it's quite clear we're both losing, but Britain's going to lose more.
U.S. President Donald Trump says that he'll leave the White House if the Electoral College votes for his rival Joe Biden to be the winner of the disputed election. He made the comments after a Thanksgiving Day address to U.S. troops at the White House. Now, this is the closest the U.S. president has come to conceding defeat in the November 3rd election. The U.S. media declared Biden winner of the election after projecting that he'll receive 270 electoral votes required to enter the Oval Office. Trump and some of his fellow Republicans claim the vote was rigged in favor of Biden and have filed several lawsuits to try to overrule election results. Electoral College is due to vote on December 14th to officially decide the outcome of the presidential vote. Joining us now out of New York is Max Perry, investigative journalist. Your thoughts on the statement made by the U.S. president?
Well, I think his statement could be interpreted in various ways. On the one hand, you know, it does seem like he's finally ceding, you know, to the narrative that of his opponents, that based on his demeanor at least, and you know, he did cave finally to the mounting pressure from his fellow Republicans to finally allow the transition process to formally begin last week. But on the other hand, you know, he, in addition to this statement, he also said that a lot was going to happen in between now and January 20th. So in my view, that could mean that he may be considering other legal avenues, including possibly trying to order the state legislatures, where there's a Republican majority in both houses in these contested states, to override the popular vote and elect pro-Trump electors to the Electoral College instead. Even if he did decide to do that, which would be an unprecedented step, obviously, and would provoke a really, really serious political or constitutional crisis, I'm not sure that enough Republican legislators would even be willing to go along with it, because they'd be committing political suicide. I do think that it's possible that Trump would be willing to try this, but even if he did, I don't know if there'd be enough Republican lawmakers that would be willing to override the popular vote, which the Trump campaign believes to be fraudulent. I'm just not sure. I think that, you know, there is a consensus building among even my fellow analysts and alternative media that Trump doesn't have any path to victory remaining, but I'm not so sure myself that this power struggle is over, that all of his avenues have been exhausted. And that could mean, as I said, trying to override the popular vote and get these state legislators to appoint pro-Trump electors, or taking it to the Supreme Court, which his campaign lawyer, Rudy Giuliani, seems dead set on doing.
Right, Max. But technically, I mean, up until now, Joe Biden really has just been the projected winner. I mean, a lot of these states say that, you know, he's gotten his fair share of the votes, and he sewed up the electoral votes for that state. But technically, December 14th is when the Electoral College makes that determination officially. So really, Trump is kind of not really too far off by saying, okay, then I will, you know, basically concede and pack my stuff and be leaving the White House, because that's when, you know, the lady sings.
Yeah, no, you're absolutely right. And, you know, his statement is ambiguous, but, you know, contrary to what many might assume, the American people don't directly choose the president. And the determination of the winner is not when the media declares the winner, or when if Trump were to concede. It's election day itself is only voting for the electors from each state, and then the governors draw up a list to the Electoral College once all the votes have been tallied, and then the electors meet in December. And you know, the fact that it is so indirect, you know, it's this election, you know, has really underscored how many people believe the U.S. Electoral system to be extremely archaic and obsolete and non-democratic.
It's funny you should say that, because come December 14th, the electors could give it to Donald Trump, and they would be within the full constitutional right to do so. It may be breaking away from standard operation of policy, but guess what? It'd be legal under the U.S. Constitution.
Right, but, you know, I think up until this point, post-election chaos that a lot of people were predicting in the months leading up to the election has been sort of anticlimactic, and it hasn't really materialized. But if Trump were to actually do this, I think that this would provoke an absolutely unprecedented political crisis where you'd see popular protest and chaos, the likes of which I've never seen, and, you know, it would maybe give some truth to the trepidation that people seem to have about a possible civil war in the United States, which, in my opinion, is hyperbole, but I do think that there would be unprecedented social unrest and chaos if Trump were to actually go forward with such a drastic move.
Thank you, Max. Always a pleasure to have you on. Out of New York, Mr. Max Perry, investigative journalist. Israel has released Palestinian inmate Maher al-Akhras, who was on hunger strike for over 100 days in protest at his detention without charge. His release is widely viewed as yet another victory for Palestinians against the Israeli regime. Mona Kandil reports.
After a long hunger strike going beyond 100 days to protest against his detention without charge or trial, Palestinian prisoner Maher al-Akhras has been finally freed. The Israeli authorities released al-Akhras from the Israeli hospital of Qaplan, where he was held for subsequent worsening of his health condition. He arrived at Al-Najah hospital in the West Bank city of Nablus following his release by Israeli authorities. After final medical examinations, he was moved to his hometown, Silat al-Dahr, north of the occupied West Bank. In a press statement, al-Akhras thanked the Palestinian people for the solidarity actions and insisted that gaining rights and liberty are only achieved through fighting.
Praise be to God that I am now among my family and my people in Nablus, and that, God willing, we will get rid of the occupation with the mighty wills of our people and live from victory to victory until we reach a greater victory and liberate Palestine.
Israel arrested al-Akhras in July over accusations of being a prominent member of the Jihad resistance group, which he denied. He immediately started his hunger strike, demanding that he should either be prosecuted for clear charges or be released. Israel at first refused to deal with his demands, but when he was at the verge of death, the Israeli High Court ruled that if al-Akhras ended his hunger strike, his administrative detention would not be renewed upon its expiration on 6th of November. Prominent figures who rushed to welcome al-Akhras praised his encouragement in what they described as defeating the occupation's authorities. Administrative detention involves no indictment, no revelation of confidential evidence, and no trial or judgment of the accusations against the prisoner. Hundreds of Palestinian prisoners are languishing in Israel's jails without charge or trial under the illegal so-called administrative detention. The inmates say their hunger strike is a bet to have their voice heard and to force the Israeli regime to end this illegal policy. Reports say more than 7,000 Palestinians are held in Israeli jails. Maher al-Akhras has achieved victory through his hunger strike, and he's free today. Experts say his battle definitely gives other Palestinian prisoners under administrative detention a glimmer of hope, enabling them to go on with their actions and their fight for justice that aim to get back their rights in Israeli jails. Mona Kandil, Occupied Ramallah.
Thank you for tuning in, and goodbye for now.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio. please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
More than 1.1 million Medicare patients in the United States of America could die over the next decade because they cannot afford to pay for their prescription medications, according to a new study released recently by the West Health Policy Center, a nonprofit and nonpartisan policy research group. If current drug pricing trends continue, researchers estimate cost-related non-adherence to drug therapy will result in the premature death of 112,000 beneficiaries a year, making it a leading cause of death in the U.S., ahead of diabetes, influenza, pneumonia, and kidney disease. Millions more will suffer worsening health conditions and run-up medical expenses that will cost Medicare an additional $177.4 billion by 2030, or $18 billion a year for the next 10 years. Dear listeners, stay with us for an article in this regard written by Kenny Stansfield Ryder. This article is published under the heading, High Drug Prices in U.S. Could Result in Premature Deaths of More Than 1.1 Million Seniors in Next Decade, analysis says. Here's the details of this article. More than 1.1 million American seniors in the Medicare program could die prematurely over the next decade because they cannot afford the exorbitant prices of prescription medications. That's according to a study released last week by the West Health Policy Center, a nonprofit and nonpartisan policy research group, and Zsanda, the research arm of AmerisourceBergen, a drug distributor. Researchers expect cost-related non-adherence to drug therapy to increase not only unnecessary suffering but also Medicare spending, as deteriorating health conditions drive up preventable expenses by more than $177 billion by 2030. Unless drug prices are reduced, the analysis estimated that 112,000 seniors per year could succumb to early death as a result of not being able to afford their medications. In addition, researchers projected that health complications stemming from the unaffordable cost of prescriptions will force Medicare to spend nearly $18 billion annually on avoidable medical expenses. Prescription drug prices have been soaring, with list prices having increased by 159% from 2007 to 2018. West Health noted that if these trends continue, cancer-related non-adherence to drug therapy will be a leading cause of death in the U.S., ahead of diabetes, influenza, pneumonia, and kidney disease. One of the biggest contributors to poor health, hospital admissions, higher healthcare costs, and preventable deaths is patients failing to take their medications as prescribed, said Timothy Lash, president of the West Health Policy Center. He added, cost-related non-adherence is a significant and growing issue that is a direct result of runaway drug prices and a failure to implement policies and regulations that make drugs more affordable. Currently, Medicare beneficiaries are required to pay 25% of the list price cost of generic and brand name medications until they reach their out-of-pocket maximum. As drug companies continue to raise list prices, the analysis explained, patients may experience a significant increase in their coinsurance cost. If Medicare were able to directly negotiate with pharmaceutical companies, as described in H.R. 3, the Elijah Cummings Lower Drug Cost Now Act, which has languished on the desk of Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell since it was passed by House Democrats in December 2019, it would result in dramatically lower prescription drug prices nationwide. H.R. 3 is backed by the Patients for Affordable Drugs Now Coalition. David Mitchell, a cancer patient and the founder of the group, said last year that the legislative proposal could help fix broken system of U.S. and ensure Americans with private and public insurance get the drugs they need at lower prices. According to the Council for Informed Drug Spending Analysis, that is CIDSA, allowing Medicare to negotiate and limit drug price increases could prevent nearly 94,000 deaths per year while also reducing Medicare spending by almost $476 billion by 2030. Sean Dixon, Director of Health Policy at West Health Policy Center and Chair of CIDSA, said that the costs of doing nothing about high drug prices are too high. Especially when policy changes such as allowing Medicare to negotiate drug prices would result in saving millions of lives and billions of dollars, he added. The price of prescription medications has skyrocketed in recent years in the United States of America. Between 2007 and 2018, list prices for branded pharmaceutical products increased by 159%, and there are few signs of it slowing. According to the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services, that is CMS, spending on prescription drugs will grow faster than any other major medical good or service over the next several years in the United States of America.
جهان ما ضبط صوت بزرگی است که صدای ما را هر کلمه‌ای که از مصادر شود.
The world we live in is a large recording apparatus which records our voice. every word of it.
One of the most outstanding features about him is that he cared for the humanity. And he mentioned this all the time and said, لأجل الإنسان, because of the humanity.
Well, within the social activities, we can count one of his greatest things that he started when he went back to Lebanon. And that was the dialogues between the different religions and تقريب المذاهب. And that's how we see, like, he was very close to the youth as well, because he used to visit the church as well. And the different schools.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim, in the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful. Assalamu alaikum to you, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. This is the teacher, and I'm Atta, the host of this program. The teacher is an analysis on the thoughts and works of the most outstanding Muslim thinkers, scholars, and philosophers all across the nation of Islam. And with me in the studio are two guest speakers, two experts from the Islamic House of Qom, to elaborate on the thoughts and works of Imam Musa Saad, one of such scholars. Dr. Murtaza Zazadeh, assalamu alaikum, brother, and welcome to this show.
Alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah. I'm glad to be here.
You're welcome. And Sayyid Mohsen Naghvi, assalamu alaikum, brother, and welcome to the show.
Alaykum assalam wa rahmatullah. Thanks for inviting.
You're welcome. So, in this new series of the program, The Teacher, we are mainly concerned with the thoughts and most outstanding elaborations and opinions of outstanding Muslim thinkers. After Sayyid Murtaza Mutahhari, we are discussing the thoughts and works of one of the other outstanding Muslim Shia scholars, that is Sayyid Musa al-Saad, mainly known as Imam Musa al-Saad, a Lebanese-Iranian cleric and philosopher who was very much famous for his open-mindedness. He was disappeared in Libya in 1978. If he is alive, may Allah give him health, and he passed away, may he rest in peace. It is still not clear, even in the news, that from 1978, where this great outstanding scholar is living. Sayyid Musa al-Saad was famous for giving outstanding lectures, and most of his audience were the average youth of Lebanon and Iran. He was famous for giving lectures in both the Arabic language and the Persian language. So for today's discussion, we want to listen to one of his Farsi audio files along with the English translation, and then we'll get to the elaboration by the scholars over here. Let's listen to that and we'll be back.
بهره بردن از زیبایی های زندگی، بهره بردن از نعمت های الهی به طور معقول و منطقی.
Enjoying the beauties of life and the divine blessings in a reasonable manner not only are allowed but also desired by God, as we have received from the traditions of the infallible Imams. So it is possible to move in a way where human's body enjoys and his soul is happy and his moods and thoughts are calm, and at the same time his self is satisfied. What good would it do those who ignore a great part of them, their instinct and natural spirit for finding God, or get drawn in their lusts and pleasure, or even retire from society and communicative life? One should educate, become a socialized person, and still remain a religious person. All these gather and unify. All will establish a single path.
Welcome back, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. The teacher, what you listened to was Imam Musa Saad, the Farsi audio file, along with the English translation. So, Dr. Azadeh, let's start with you for this episode, brother. This religion for life also is misunderstood, brother, sometimes. Because we find some of the religious people who are spending on the way of Allah, but they get to excessive use of, we can say, the money and the materials around them. And they think because they are spending for the religion of Allah, so they find salvation in this world. This is also, I mean, this religion for life is also might be misunderstood by some of the Muslims. Isn't it true, brother?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Yeah, misunderstandings can happen for anyone, you know, spending the gifts that God has given you in an improper way can happen for every person, regardless of their faith, if they do not have a proper understanding of the wisdom behind these gifts.
I know, but sometimes the people do not give it religious color. I mean, sometimes our expenditure and spending of the money and the charity that we are given are considered in the religious framework, okay?
You mean so, they are not giving it a religious, or they are giving?
They are. They are giving it a religious framework, but at the same time, it seems that it is not the proper way.
You know, I think in many cases, the problem is something else. People know that they are doing right. In rare cases, not in most cases, people may really be misunderstanding. But in most cases, those people who are doing that type of things, they know that they are wrong, but they are using religion as a means to justify their wrongdoings. And that is even worse than those people who are doing these things without the name of the religion. Okay. Because if you are exploiting religion in order to justify your wrongdoings, that is even a worse crime.
A worse crime than those people who do not believe
absolutely,
in religion.
Absolutely, because you are actually deviating or defacing religion for your own benefit. And this is much worse. So we have those people whom their ultimate desire is this world, and the only thing that they care about is having a fancy, extravagant life for themselves.
Yes.
They don't care about the spirituality or good life. Mm-hmm. But still, because they are living in a religious society or community, or because they are being somehow blamed by they feel guilty because they feel guilty and they know that they are right. They use the name of religion in order to justify themselves, or in order even to in order to calm themselves down.
Yeah.
And but at the end of the day, if they refer back to their own, if they reflect on it, they know that they are doing something which is not proper.
Yeah, I mean, the religion sometimes, Said Mohsen Naqvi, is decorated with the money that is taken out of the religion itself. I could vividly remember when this tower was going to be built in the Saudi Arabia, just right across from the Holy House of the Kaaba.
Right.
And the pictures were out.
Crown Tower.
Yeah.
The King's Tower.
The King's Tower, okay? So the main question was that when this simple cube is going to attract the people, so what is this tower doing over here?
Yeah.
I mean, spending the money that is taken out of the religion, but not for the religion, but for materialistic usage. This is not only, limited to, Saudi Arabia. We could see it in other Muslim lands that unfortunately this, a luxurious lifestyle is getting into. And luxurious lifestyle sometimes when you give it the religious color.
Exactly.
And religious decoration.
It's something very which is much not dangerous. Religious.
It becomes very much dangerous.
Exactly.
Because the people that are doing there, for sure, they are not doing it for the sake of religion. And the people who are attracted to it are not, for sure, attracted for the sake of religion, but for the money that is around it. Do you have any criticism on that, brother?
Well, obviously, it is said, al-amr bayn al-amrayn.
Okay.
You need to choose the medium way, the mediative way.
The moderate way.
We have a verse in the Quran, even regarding what we spend in the path of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, which is known as infaq. Mm-hmm. And Allah is talking about those people who does infaq, who spend in the path of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, who does charity. Who are they? Allah says in chapter Furqan, verse 67, that وَالَّذِينَ إِذَا أَنْفَقُوا لَمْ يُصْرِفُوا وَلَمْ يَقْتُرُوا وَكَانَ بَيْنَ ذَلِكَ قَوَامًا. Which means that those who basically spend in the path of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala or does charity, they neither waste, like they spend a lot of the money into the charity, nor they keep like a lot and spend some of the money. But وَكَانَ بَيْنَ ذَلِكَ قَوَامًا. But surely they are basically, and the just means is ever between these two. So Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala is clearly saying this into the Quran as well, that a mu'min, a believer, is the one who choose the middle way, the moderate way, not going to the extreme and not being like, not even spending even a penny on this cause.
Yes.
The things that we see in the religion is because that we have this hadith as well in the Nahjul Balagha. Imam Ali alayhi salatu wasalam has also mentioned about this, that the people, they live their life without the religion, and then in order to show that they are religious, for example, or they're the Muslims or religious, They add religion up to the amount of the salt that we add in our food.
That is a spice.
Yeah, the spice, okay. In order to have some taste of the religion.
But
for example,
but we know that the religion is the food itself, not the spice.
The religion is actually food.
Okay.
And then this entertainment should be up to the amount of the spice or the salt that we should have.
Nice distinction that there is religion as the food or the spice of the life.
Exactly. But it's the other way around.
Okay.
And the problem is, for example, if I can give example, like our youth or the people in the West, usually they go to the parties. They do not, for example, do hijab, or for the boys even, they do not have their own hijab as well. Obviously, the man should have the veil of
haya,
the eyes,
haya
and
that's
all
right.
those.
The chastity, that's
the,
right.
The chastity and everything. We don't see these things in the youth.
Okay.
But on the other side, in order to show that they are religious and they're Muslims, they just pray. Or, for example, they fast in the month of Ramadan.
Mm-hmm.
In order to just show that they're also religious. For example, whenever it comes to the ladies, all the boys, they say, like, hijab is wajib on the ladies.
Uh-huh.
Yeah? It's on the others, basically. We try to apply religion on others, not ourselves.
Oh, very good. Very good.
That's another issue.
Very good case.
That whenever you try to apply things on the others and you think that religion is something for the
others,
not me.
For others, not themselves. That's right.
Not me. That's the problem where we see these things are happening. And if we today see, like, for example, these two towers that you said next to the Kaaba, the people go to the Kaaba in order to get near to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala.
Yes.
And obviously, they don't have these worldly desires. They're not after worldly desires when they go to the Kaaba.
If it was so, Prophet Muhammad did not break the idols, brother.
The
inside
prophet,
and around
the
it.
The Prophet himself was against this system of kings and the...
idolatry.
The
king system, monarchy
the
system.
The monetary system.
Yes.
Obviously, he was against it.
Yes.
And the system that has been introduced by the Islam and the Quran is the system of Imam and Ummah. It's the system of leader and the nation. The followers of a leader.
Yes.
And this leader should be living according to the standards that a medium or the lower people that they're living. And that's what we see in the life of the Prophet as well. That the Prophet's lifestyle, his house, his clothes, and Imam Ali alayhi salatu wasalam was according to the lower level of the people.
Thank you very much, Sayyid Mosenawi. Doctor, is there anything to add, brother?
I just wanted to mention just one very short thing about what you said about the reason behind these things.
Yes.
You know, doing something bad and giving it a good name, just like coloring it with the name of religion or any other good thing, is a type of hypocrisy. And, you know, it is much worse than doing something bad without trying to color it with something good. And this is why hypocrisy is much worse than unbelief. In the Quran, hypocrites have been given the harshest, let's say, warnings, and they will be punished in the worst possible way on the day of judgment, because not only they are doing the bad thing, but also they are defacing the religion, and they are the religion of God, and they have a much worse influence on the minds of other people about the religion
That's
of
right.
God.
Okay.
And this is what makes it even worse, because there may be some people who really want to know the truth and they want to follow the religion of God. But when they see that some people who are being called religious, Muslims or whatever, they are having those types of lifestyles that everyone knows that these are not proper, they will be misguided.
Then they will rely on the other sources.
Yes, they will be misguided. And this misguidance and actually misleading people will be written on the shoulders of those people who are doing those things. And so the danger and the risk of those people who are doing these things is much worse than even unfaithful people.
So according to Imam Musa Asad, religion of Islam is for life, but not getting to the extremes or being excessive or mask, we can say, the consumption of all the resources around us. So we are doing, and sometimes I think that we are spending this wealth, you know, and we want to get to the end of this world in order to finish it and get to the other world sooner, so that what's happening over there. But Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala keeps his blessings and na'amat and all these mercies in this world, but in the proper moderate way.
Absolutely.
As you both, dear experts, believe in that. Thank you very much, Dr. Azadeh.
You're very welcome.
Very nice elaboration, Sayyid Mohsen Naqvi. Thank you very much. And dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, thank you very much again for listening to this episode of the program, The Teacher. Please visit our website, parstoday.com/Ian Call of Islam page, also our YouTube page, Call of Islam Radio. To another episode, God bless you all. Fi amanallah.
IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/EN.
U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo's public addresses, interviews, and other remarks are characterized by bravado, hate-mongering, big lies, and mass deception. U.S. foreign policy with him at State Department has been one of the darkest chapters in the nation's history. Recently, the CIA-connected Washington Post slammed his legacy of incompetence, adding, "It peaked with his failed Iran policy." His latest moves, visiting an illegal Israeli settlement in occupied Golan Heights, were as mean-spirited as misguided. His intention to further sanction Iran weekly through 20th of January is perfectly consistent with his track record of staging poorly conceived publicity stunts rather than undertaking any actual diplomacy with the government of Iran. He and the Trump administration overall have been all sticks and no carrots geopolitically. We now present you an article written by Stephen Lenman, a Chicago-based research author, research associate of the Center for Research on Globalization, and host of the Progressive Radio News Hour. The piece is titled "Loose Cannon: Pompeo's War of Words on Iran." Please stay with us for more. Words could kill, loose cannon, Mike Pompeo's remarks would be considered weapons of mass destruction. The big lie about an Iranian threat has been around for decades. Ignored is that Washington's only threats are invented, none are real. What's been geopolitically clear since the Second World War ended. In stark contrast, hardliners from both right wings of the U.S. war party threaten everyone everywhere. U.S. imperial aims, by diabolical means used to advance them, represent an unparalleled threat to humanity. The Islamic Republic of Iran is the region's leading proponent of peace and stability. Its ruling authorities pursue cooperative relations with other countries and confrontation with none. Long-standing U.S. plans for regime change are all about its sovereign independence. Nations free from its imperial control aren't tolerated. In West Asia, they're an obstacle to U.S. and Israeli hegemonic aims. In Iran's case, long-standing U.S. hostility towards the country is also about wanting to control Iran's vast hydrocarbon reserves. The Trump regime hardliners escalated war on Iran by other means, beyond where their predecessors went. My previous article discussed possible U.S. aggression and threats against Iran during what may be Donald Trump's final weeks in office. While he continues inherited hot wars in Afghanistan, Syria, and Yemen, and wage greater wars than ever by other means against targeted countries, he did not initiate new aggression on his watch. With 2 months of his tenure remaining, if legal challenges to brazen election fraud fail, will he go at the 11th hour where he hasn't gone before? Would he risk embroiling West Asia in greater than ever conflict since the Second World War ended, during what may be his final days in office? Would he want to be remembered for launching what could develop into catastrophic war as his parting shot as U.S. President and Commander-in-Chief? Would he risk more greatly tainting his record in office than already? I believe a Trump regime war on Iran before 20th of January is highly unlikely. At the same time, war of words on the Islamic Republic and piling on more illegal sanctions will continue over the next 2 months and beyond. As long as Iran refuses to subordinate its sovereign rights to U.S. interests, what no nation should do, it will remain a prime target for regime change. That's how the scourge of imperialism works, permitting no nation to remain free from its iron grip. On Monday, 23rd of November, hawkish U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo concluded visits with officials in France, Turkey, Georgia, United Arab Emirates, Qatar, Saudi Arabia, and occupied Palestine. Before leaving the occupied Palestinian territories, he was interviewed by the Zionist regime's daily The Jerusalem Post. Asked if all Trump administration options remain on the table against Iran, Pompeo claimed, of course. The administration has been clear on that for its entire 4 years, he added. There is no reason that would change that today or tomorrow. Defying reality, he falsely claimed maximum pressure success. President Donald Trump's regime's West Asian policies overall made the U.S. more of a pariah state than already. Iran today is much stronger politically and militarily than when Donald Trump took office, its latter strength solely for defensive purposes. Its geopolitical agenda is polar opposite of how the U.S. operates on the world stage, waging peace and stability in stark contrast to Washington's war on humanity. Mike Pompeo's public addresses, interviews, and other remarks are characterized by bravado, hate-mongering, big lies, and mass deception. U.S. foreign policy with him at the State Department has been one of the darkest chapters in America's history. Recently, the CIA-connected Washington Post slammed his legacy of incompetence, adding, "It peaked with his failed Iran policy. His latest move, visiting an illegal Israeli settlement and the occupied Golan Heights, were as mean-spirited as misguided." His intention to further sanction Iran weekly through to 20th of January is perfectly consistent with his track record of staging poorly perceived publicity stunts rather than undertaking any actual diplomacy with the government of Iran. He said the Trump regime overall has been all sticks and no carrots geopolitically, its so-called maximum pressure policy only disrupting the import of medicines and food for ordinary Iranians who are fighting the coronavirus pandemic. The Trump regime's maximum pressure policy has been a total bust. Pompeo's interview with Jerusalem Post was characterized by a litany of bold-faced big lies, an absence of hard truths. He lied saying Iran foments regional harm, a US-NATO-Israeli speciality, not how Tehran operates anywhere. Claiming Trump regime actions against Iran isolated the country is belied by reality. He lied calling Trump's geopolitical agenda a vision of peace, an anathema notion in Washington. Pompeo lied accusing Iran of being prime actor who is causing instability in West Asia. He is spearheading an effort to try to prevent the United States from returning to the JCPOA if Biden-Harris administration replaces the Trump administration on 20th of January. He reinvented the Trump regime's West Asia agenda, claiming continuation of the things we've been doing leads to a very increased likelihood of a safer, more prosperous region, and that our Israeli friends will be safer and more secure as a result of that as well. Pretending concern for Palestinian rights ignored nearly 4 years of Trump regime's trampling on Palestinian rights. Trump's domestic and geopolitical agendas have been virtually wrecking balls for ordinary people both at home and abroad. They've been a gift that keeps on giving to the wealthy, power and privilege interests at the expense of most people everywhere. Trump will be remembered as a bombastic businessman, geopolitical know-nothing, reality TV president. Mike Pompeo will be remembered as a thug masquerading as a diplomat. The last 4 years will be remembered as one of America's darkest chapters. What's coming will likely be worse domestically and geopolitically, no matter which wing of U.S. geopoly rule controls the White House and or the Congress.
Iranian news, Iranian culture, Iranian voice. This is IRIB English Radio.